As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Welcome to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. We give voice to those who challenge a prevailing sentiment in global financial markets. This podcast is for informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests were not compensated for their appearance, nor do they supply payment in order to appear. Individuals on this podcast may hold positions in the securities that are discussed. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. This podcast episode may have ads and the occasional announcement. To listen without ads or announcements and take advantage of a host of other benefits, consider becoming a premium subscriber. Visit the website contrarian.supercast.tech. That's TECH for more information. Now, here's your host, Mr. Nathaniel E. Baker.
I'm here with Mark Higgins. You are an investment advisor at Index Fund Advisors, where you're a vice president, senior vice president?
Correct.
One of those. But more importantly, you have written a book here. You're a book author, and you've written this book titled Investing in U.S. Financial History, Understanding the Past to Forecast the Future. I've always said that financial history, market history specifically, is not something that is written and discussed enough, other than the inevitable comparisons to 1929, I guess, that you see every so often. And we're going to get into the book, and you have six lessons that you talk about in the conclusion, which I want to talk to, which I want to get to. But first, since you are a historian of this, and you've written this very comprehensive book, by the way, it goes all the way back to 1790 and Alexander Hamilton, I thought it'd be interesting to ask you what period from the past compares most closely with the one that we're living in right now.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, thank you, Nate, for having me on the show. I really appreciate it. I've got a few of your past shows, and they've been very informative. But you know, to answer your question, one of the themes at the end of the book is, and it took a while for me to appreciate that, is history doesn't really repeat exactly. What is really helpful about studying history is you understand key principles, key underlying currents that tend to recur, and they piece together in different ways. So, you know, the period that, if you, not just currently, but over the past 4 years, there were several incidents that happened in the past. A lot of them, there's just nobody alive anymore that remembers them. The initial shock of COVID was a lot like the July 1914 shock of World War I. But what was most important, the two things that are most important were when the inflation set in after COVID, and call it roughly in the spring of 2021, it was very similar, and for very similar reasons in terms of the underlying drivers, to the post-World War I and great influenza inflation that really started in 1919 and 1920. It prompted a very aggressive Fed response, led to a recession, very similar to what we're at least experiencing right now. Now, and this is a way that things combine in different ways, that really isn't the most relevant point of comparison anymore. The most relevant point of comparison now is the late 1960s and 1970s, because one of the mistakes that the Fed made, and believe me, they're aware of it, they reference it, not, you know, specifically outright, but you can see it in the language of in their minutes, in their public statements. One of the big mistakes at that time was the Fed tightened monetary policy but backed off too early And that is what allowed inflation, higher inflation expectations to set in. The Fed lost their credibility. And that led to the great inflation of 1965 to 1982. So that now that inflation has gone on for almost 3 years after COVID, that is really the event that the Fed is most concerned with. And I've been writing quite a bit about that. That's why I've been convinced that the Fed's going to remain tight for longer than people think.
Interesting. Okay. Take me back to this 1965 to 1982 period. I was not alive for all of it. And the parts mm-hmm. I was alive for, I was too young to be paying attention. But talk to me. So they had loose monetary policy in the mid late 60s?
So, I mean, there are a lot of issues and there's a whole chapter. It's one of the most important chapters in the book right now because of what's going on. It's called Inflated Expectations. There are a lot of issues going on then in terms of the Vietnam War and a real pickup in deficit spending. There was also, and you have to get yourself into their mentality. In the late 1960s, World War II and the Great Depression were still fresh in people's minds. And people were very scarred by unemployment. And, you know, unemployment was almost, you know, call it on average 20% for 10 years in the 1930s. The Great Depression absolutely caused World War II. And that's something I read about quite a bit in the book as well. And people were scarred from it. So there was a bias toward minimizing unemployment. And people weren't scared of inflation. In fact, deflation was a bigger issue, you know, in their history. So whenever the Fed would tighten and there was a threat to unemployment, there was a threat to growth, there's also a lot of political pressure at the time, they would back off too early. And that's essentially there were other issues, don't get me wrong, but that was really the big issue that caused the great inflation.
Right.
At least one of that caused the great inflation.
And then there was a couple of recessions in the 70s.
Yeah.
And was that what kind of caused them to backtrack?
Well, that's the thing. And when there was signs that the economy was tipping into recession or unemployment was starting to tick up again, they would back off and it was premature.
Yeah. That does sound...
Every time they had to go back, it was harder. And you've heard, I don't know if it was the last press release or the previous one, you've heard Powell reference this before, saying, you know, history shows that if you fail to contain inflation and it pops back up, it's going to be harder the second time around. He's referencing the 70s.
Right. Of course, one could also argue that the Fed maybe hasn't learned of its own mistakes. If you look at what happened in the late 90s and early 2000s, Greenspan's favorite famous irrational exuberance speech coming in 96. Yeah. And then I believe it didn't cut rates after that. Well, because of long-term capital, but still.
The Fed makes mistakes. I mean, it's not an easy job too. I mean, it's
no question.
It's a pretty hard job, but a lot of the effects of what they're doing are lagged. You know, it's constantly a learning process to a large degree, but you know, I think most people would agree that the Fed has really made two major errors, and one was the Great Depression and their failure to back up the banking system and allowing the banking system to implode, essentially. And then the Great Inflation, which was not taming inflation early and aggressively and allowing it to set in. I mean, are there little errors here and there? Yes. To me, those are the big errors that the Fed's made.
So you don't see that the real estate bubble in the 2000s as being one of the major errors of the Fed.
You know, it's funny. There's a call out in the book that I talk about, which is whenever you have big financial crises, there's always a temptation to blame somebody to pick out the biggest culprit. The chapter on the global financial crisis, which I titled the Great Shadow Bank Run, which is essentially what it was. It was a run on the shadow banking system. And the problem is these things kind of happen as a supply chain, right? It's like they're irresponsible mortgage originators. They are passing it off to investment banks who are structuring it and passing it off to, you know, money market funds who are investing it. There's a whole supply chain and nobody saw. Everybody, it was kind of like old maid, you know, they passed the thing along the supply chain and then all of a sudden the music stopped. And I would say investment bankers probably took the bulk of the blame, the Federal Reserve for not seeing the whole thing. But at the end of the day, systemic crises like these can never be blamed on a single individual. It's frustrating, but there were so many people that contributed to it, none of whom really knew the garbage that was coming out on the end of the supply chain line.
Yeah. Okay. Fair enough. All right. So back to this 65 to 82. Obviously, what finally ended it was Volcker coming in and setting interest rates at some 10% or something crazy.
Oh, it went up to 20.
20%.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So, right. Okay. So you think that the Fed has that was their major lesson, and it would make sense. So what prompted this softer rhetoric? And Powell said in December that risks were also even. No, he might have even said that risks
I don't see
were.
That. I don't see it even, like, to be clear. But anyway, I see.
Okay.
Far skewed toward laying off the rate, really. Yeah.
Of course, but what did he say? Didn't he say the risks were even between over tightening and over? He said that, right?
He did. I mean, I don't see it that way. But the, you know, when he came, so the first signs of trouble, I wrote a newsletter. I have a free newsletter, and I wrote a newsletter. I think it was actually, I know it was. It was October 31st. It was called the Siren Song of a Soft Landing. It was getting louder or something like that. I forget the official title. But what became what prompted that was, I think it was on September 28th, Austin Goolsbee, the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago, gave a speech where he didn't say that they were going to get dovish, but he was definitely hinting at, you know, almost taking a premature victory lap on the Fed navigating a soft landing. And that seemed pretty dangerous, because past precedent would suggest that when this ends, now it's gone on longer than everyone anticipated, but when this ends, the odds are we will have a period where it goes in the other direction. And when he was that premature victory lap, and then it was followed by sort of the dovish signaling of the Fed in December, that seemed really dangerous. And you know, I wrote it at the time that they've left enough room to backtrack, which I thought they would do, but you know, it was premature and it was not a good signal. Now, I don't think they went far enough that they couldn't pull back, and you're seeing them pull back now, but it was definitely a mistake. But again, you know, the Fed's made big mistakes. I would consider that a small one that they could get out pretty easily, and I think they have.
Yeah. And do you think there's a chance they could tighten again?
Yeah, it's hard to predict that kind of stuff, because it's so data. I mean, they don't know. You know, it's very data dependent. I wouldn't say it's impossible, but I think if they had kept with their dovish stance, I think it would have been a lot more likely, because I think the market would have responded more enthusiastically. But you know, I maintain the position that it's going to be tighter for longer. Whether they have to raise rates, I don't know. I doubt it, but it's certainly possible.
Yeah. None of which is good for bonds, one would suspect.
No.
Yeah.
I mean, long-term, none of that stuff really concerns me that much, but yeah.
Sure.
Sick of me yet? Become a premium subscriber and avoid all ads or interruptions. Other benefits as well. Visit contrarian.supercast.tech for more information.
Yeah, but it's interesting, though. In your book, you talk about it's very much a history of panics also.
There are a lot of them. That's where you learn.
The first one was in 1792. Was it around the first bank, the first national? And then Panic of 1819, Panic of 1837, Panic of 1873, Panic of 1893, Panic of 1907. Yeah. And those were all runs on the banks, basically.
Yeah, not all. I mean, some of them, they were different, but there were usually bank runs accompany.
Yeah. And so, which is what ultimately led to the Fed, the Federal Reserve Act of 1913.
Yeah.
Which, in fairness, other than the Great Depression, we have not seen bank runs.
Not like the Great Depression. No.
Yeah. And we had last year, we had a couple of bank failures. And what do you make of all that? And
so, I mean, this is another benefit of studying financial history, especially the panic of 1907, even more so than the Great Depression. Just studying the dynamics of a bank run, when you see one, you know the response is going to be aggressive, especially if it's for a systemic reason, which it was in this case, which is people had a rational incentive if they had more than $250,000 and, you know, they're beyond the FDIC limits to pull it out. Mm-hmm. And when you see something like that, you knew the Fed was going to do something big and aggressive that weekend to stop it. And they did. So again, another benefit of just having been around, you feel sometimes when I joke about it, I obviously I'm don't mean to sound weird but sometimes it feels like I've been alive for a couple hundred years. I would sit and read newspapers during the time period all weekend. And granted, that's not the same as time travel, but sometimes you feel like you've seen these things before, and you kind of know what will happen. And in both cases, if the Fed does the right thing, you know it's going to get stemmed. And but if they do the wrong thing, I mean that was a very dangerous situation with the Silicon Valley Bank run, and the Fed did the right thing in my opinion and acted quickly. You have to act quickly in these situations because they can spiral out of control very, very fast.
And another interesting discussion, of course, is the role of technology. And you get into this in the book as well. And so what do you make of all that? I mean, it seems like a lot of this, financial innovation that has kind of each one has led more retail investors into the market in many ways. Talk to me about that.
Well, I mean, there's a general, in terms of contrarian, I guess, to fit on your show, there's definitely in the retail, and even more so, my experiences with institutional investors, with institutional investment plans like endowments, foundations, and pension plans. And there's over the past 40 years, there's been this steady march toward increasing complexity in portfolios without, at least in my opinion, proper consideration of the offsetting costs. And I don't know if technology has played as much a role in that, but it's gone back past the, in my opinion, from what I've seen, it's gone past the point, way past the point where the costs justify the increased complexity in portfolios.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah, and you talk about this in the book about how, the Swensen model, David Swensen at Yale, their endowment, the late David Swensen, I believe he passed.
He did. It was tragic. I wish I wish I had a chance to meet him. I would have.
He so but anyway, the Yale endowment was held up as a model because it there's so people thought invested a lot in alternatives, hedge funds and such. And it turns out that that is not for a very you have to really know what you're doing there.
Exactly. And that was so the he David Swensen joined Yale in 1985. And at the end of the day, he was a very skilled investor, but even more than that, he was a skilled mentor. I don't know if you've talked to people from the Yale program, but they all say the same thing. He was a great teacher, great mentor. A lot of the investors that joined went off and did their own thing and had equal amounts of success. And they attributed to just his, and they weren't necessarily investors when they joined the Yale Investments Office. He's a great teacher, great mentor, great steward of the investment committee to and ensured adequate governance of the endowment, which is often a problem with institutional investors. So that was really what differentiated him. Yes, he got in early with venture capital, got in at the right time with private equity, but he was a skilled investor who could train great investors and manage the governance in a very effective way at Yale. And that's just not something that is easy to repeat. So if you look at that as the competitive advantage, that you have to get that in place before you do the types of things that David Swensen did. And unfortunately, people have it backward. They think that if they just allocate to venture capital and private equity and hedge funds, that they're going to get Yale-like returns. But without the appropriate governance skill and repeatability, it's just it's more likely to fail.
Buyer beware. And is there anything in history as far as the history of, I guess, currencies of exchange? I mean, the US dollar, it's been around since the beginning, but it's been different ways that it was valued and even created. Like prior to the Civil War, you had these state charters and stuff. And I asked that
State
because of
Charter
all
Bank.
these, yeah, the all the digital currencies.
It reminds me of that. Honestly, it does.
Talk to me about that. How did that work? In what way?
The people money wasn't the same 150 years ago. And there was a US dollar, which was usually backed, a state chartered bank would have reserves of gold and silver, and then they would issue US dollars that were exchangeable for gold and silver. But depending on what bank you got the dollar from, another bank may not redeem it at face value. I mean, the value of a dollar varied depending on what bank issued it. There wasn't a central bank. There was at various times, but there wasn't a central bank during a lot of the 1800s. And it just kind of reminds me. So you had all these dollars issued by different banks that had various values, and it It's a little different, but it sort of reminds me of the cryptocurrency, where you have a bunch of different cryptocurrencies, and they're fluctuating in value, and it seems like at least part of the cryptocurrency movement is distrust of central banking, and distrust of, particularly with regard to the rising debt in the United States. Although to me, that's more of a federal government issue than a central banking issue, but that's a whole other issue. So yeah, it does remind me of the various currencies flying around in the 1800s issued by state chartered banks.
Interesting. Yeah, look, I mean, there's probably a reason that there's a central bank, and they've tried it other ways,
Exactly.
right?
They got rid of it twice and brought it back. I mean, there's a reason for it.
Exactly. And like I said, you did have all these bank runs in the late
Yeah.
19th century.
Yeah.
This is all very interesting, Mark. I want to take a quick break and come
Okay.
back and ask you some more questions about yourself, how you got into this, and then talk some more about the book and the lessons that are contained therein. But let's first take a quick break. If you are a premium subscriber, you will not get the break. Don't touch the dial. We'll be right back. In fact, we already are. And to become a premium subscriber, visit the website contrarianpod.substack.com and sign up.
We hope you're enjoying this episode of the Contrarian Investor Podcast, where we give voice to those who challenge a prevailing narrative in global financial markets. Consider becoming a premium subscriber. For $9 a month or less, premium subscribers receive a number of benefits. Podcasts are posted immediately after they're recorded. Transcripts are made available within 24 hours. Premium subscribers get direct access to the host. And of course, there are no ads or interruptions. Visit contrarian.supercast.tech for more information.
By the way, you don't need the .tech suffix to get to that website. .com will do the trick. And we also have a Substack that you can where you can sign up for the same prices, same benefits, same details. contrarianpod.substack.com. So if you already have a Substack account and use it, or have the app and use that, that's probably the best way to go. So contrarian.supercast.com or contrarianpod.substack.com, whole bunch of benefits, including, of course, getting this episode up to a week early without ads or annoying announcements. And you also get the Daily Contrarian briefing and podcast that is released every market day morning at 7 a.m. This is a contrarian take on the events of the day ahead and what is likely to move markets, such as economic data releases, earnings, and other things. It is really good, and that is completely unbiased, of course. So check that out, contrarianpod.substack.com or contrarian.supercast.tech. Now on with the show. Welcome back, everybody. Here with Mark Higgins, author of this very insightful book, History: Investing in U.S. Financial History, Understanding the Past to Forecast the Future. Mark, this is the segment of the show where we ask our guests to tell us a little bit more about themselves, how they came to investing in the first place. In your case, this is your first book?
It is. Now, I've
Yeah,
been a
so.
writer. Writing has always been something that I've kind of done at a lot of different positions in my career. So it's not new, but this is my first book. Yeah.
Okay. So tell us first how you got into investing in the first place, what
Sure.
your education and career was like, and then how you got
So it was
around to
mainly
writing the
after
book.
business school. And in business school, I just really developed a passion for investing. And I was interested in investment consulting because it seemed like that was kind of at the top of in terms of decision making. So I spent about 12 years in investment consulting, and really what prompted the writing of the book was COVID. So in March 2020, when COVID hit, I was caught flat-footed. I didn't know how to advise endowments and foundations. Everything, it just seemed like the world was blowing up. And I honestly don't even remember what prompted it, but I started reading books on financial history, just searching for some precedents to understand what was going on. And the more I read over months and months and months, the more I appreciated, it was more helpful to tie the present to precedents in the past to calm, largely to calm clients down, than it was to just kind of track what's most current in the markets. And I also realized that I was there were so many good books out there. I probably read 200 plus, but there was no good single volume book that explained in a way that was accessible to non-academics the financial history of the United States from 1790 to today. And it was an ambitious endeavor, but I do have a lot of experience writing, and I decided to take a shot at it. And it was by far the most difficult intellectual and emotional experience of my entire life. If you look around, you can't really see it because my background's blurred, but I have 3,000 note cards lining the walls here, and
Wow.
you could literally walk around the room and go from 1790 all the way to 2023, and that's how I did it.
Interesting. Did you come across any of these? There are these stories that circulate on Wall Street. The one is about J.P. Morgan and the Shoeshine Boy. I don't know if it's J.P. Morgan or if it's
I actually think it was Joe Kennedy.
that I was going to say.
Or Bernard Baruch. It's a
I've
rumor.
seen it
I know
attributed to a
what you're
bunch
talking
of
about.
different peoples. So there's that one, and then there's the one about J.P. Morgan locking people in a room.
That's true.
That's true. Yeah, that happened in
The
the which one, nine, was that the 97,
Panic
90?
of 1907. So J. Pierpont
And
Morgan was so one of the challenges during the Panic of 1907 was it was really a run on trust companies, which were a form of state charter bank. And the national banking system actually did pretty well. But for reasons that I explained in the book, the trust executives didn't really work together very well in a panic. And they needed to raise, I think it was $25 million within a day. And J. Pierpont Morgan, he would go by Pierpont. I don't know, it's a little inside nomenclature, I guess, but he's fed up with them, and they would meet at the Morgan Library, and he got all the executives there and said, "You need to come up with 25 million," left the room and locked it behind him. It's a true story.
nice. And they came up with it, right? Yeah.
They did come up with it.
Did the Shoeshine Boy happen, or is that just a parable?
I looked into that, and I couldn't. I saw that, and that's referring to the before the 1929 crash. I saw it attributed to Joe Kennedy. I think it was also attributed to Bernard Baruch, who was also got out of the market before the crash of 1929, but it's never been confirmed. I don't really know if it's true.
It sounds like one of these that are, but it
Yeah,
doesn't
and the
matter because
story
it's a great
is,
story.
the shoe shine boy was recommending stocks to purchase, and the comment was, "When my shoe shine boy is recommending stocks, it's time to get
It's time
out."
to get
And
out. And he
the
sold that
person was
day and
not
it crashed the
exactly
next week.
unintelligent. That means once those people, bubbles get caused and by people flooding into the market and popping something up, and once there's no more money, it comes out. And by the time it gets to, the theory was that by the time it got to the shoe shine boy, there's nobody left.
Yeah, that's yes, and I think that there's a lot of truth to that. Do you see this in your studies of these things? Is there any obvious peak of the bubble other than that one, that people can maybe look
Bubbles are the
for?
hardest things. The reason that bubbles are so hard is because they're usually caused by the introduction of a new technology that actually is valuable. You just don't know how valuable it is. So, I mean, the dot-com is a great example. And I think AI is a great example. It reminds me of the dot-com. The internet was revolutionary. I mean, it was absolutely revolutionary. And e-commerce was revolutionary, but it was undefinable. And you didn't know how long it would take. And then you also have the added problem of a bunch of people that just join the herd. All of a sudden everyone's e-commerce, and so it's hard to differentiate what's real and what's not. And that's what's so hard about a bubble is, everyone says that they can identify it, and the people who do identify it are tagged as gurus when in fact some of them are just lucky. It's a very hard thing to do. I mean, I have. In the book, I do have a little call out on some warning signs of bubbles. One of the funnier ones, and again, this is something you only see when you go back far enough, is the media tends to get in pretty late in the game, and you start seeing things appear in the media pretty late. So in 1929, actually, I think it was 1928, the New York Times, a big cause of the crash in 1929 was margin, buying a margin. And all of a sudden, the New York Times started reporting margin rates in 1928. Yeah. So you saw that. Then the NASDAQ all of a sudden appeared as an index right before the crash. And then cryptocurrency started appearing on CNBC right before, Bitcoin collapsed. So you start seeing warning signs, but it's very difficult. And it's treacherous to try to time it because you're dealing with madness.
It's insane. Yeah, that's interesting. I thought you were going to say the magazine cover when you started talking about media, because that's another one that's
That's another
actually,
good one. I've seen that. You saw Theranos. I've seen something posted on Forbes. Forbes tended to say, the latest guru is Theranos or Sam Bankman-Fried, and 2 months later, the whole thing falls apart.
Yeah, or Barron's is another one that this Twitter account picks on every Saturday, more as a tongue in cheek as a joke. But okay, I want to talk about public debt, which you write about in the book. And the US has a long and tortured history. Well, for most of its history is pretty tortured with public
Well,
debt.
I mean, for most of it, it's actually pretty good. It started pretty tortured. So after the Revolutionary War and after, well, after the signing of the Constitution, the ratification of the Constitution in 1788, the finances were a mess. And bonds issued to fund the war by different states were trading at as low as 20 cents on the dollar. And one of the big things that Alexander Hamilton did was he consolidated all the debt under the federal government and then got Congress to raise tariffs in order to fund it. And he also established, not in writing, but well, it's memorialized in writing, but his desire to the Hamiltonian principle of the debt should be used during times of emergency, mainly foreign war, and then repaid once that emergency subsided. And the United States largely adhered to that. So we ran up the debt in the War of 1812, paid it back, ran up the debt in the Civil War, paid it back. World War I, same thing, paid it back. And then World War II hit. And after World War II, a few things changed fundamentally. One, we had most of the world's gold. We had about 70%. And under Bretton Woods, gold was essentially money. So we were very wealthy. Even more importantly, we had most of the industrial infrastructure of the world was severely damaged or destroyed. And ours was not only intact, but much bigger because we had armed under the art, it was called the Arsenal of Democracy. We had armed our allies in addition to ourselves. So we were very wealthy and we were generating a lot of wealth. And that got us into the mentality that we could afford a lot more than we had in the past. And we established a lot of programs. It kind of culminated with the Great Society in the mid-1960s. And we abandoned, without really stating it, but we abandoned that Hamiltonian principle of only running up the debt during a time of emergency and then paying it back. Instead, we've been running chronic fiscal deficits now for 50, 60 years. It's just a different mentality. And the challenge of communicating that to the public is nobody remembers what it was like when we lived under those Hamiltonian principles prior to really the 1930s.
And it's compounded by the fact that you used to have a party that claimed to be for fiscal conservatism and restraint. And it seems like there's a few people that make some noise to that.
Not
But very few, and mostly like both parties have got religion now on deficit, on debt, right? And what can, I mean, it's just not political. Why would they stop,
That's the
right?
problem because politicians are, it's a long term, it's not like it's going to blow up tomorrow, but we cannot keep spending at this rate. I mean, the projections 30 years from now are just, they're unsustainable. And the challenge is politicians are motivated by short-term priorities of the voters. And if that, and it usually isn't, fixing something that's going to be way out there in terms of a problem, it's hard to get politicians to focus on it. But the problem is it's actually solvable if we do it slowly. It's like, paying off a mortgage. If you're going to pay it off in a week, you got a problem. But if you're going to pay it off in 30 years, you can manage it. But the longer we wait, the more painful it's going to be to get our hand around this.
Do you see any currency replacing the US dollar as a global reserve currency?
The only thing I could say on that is the dominant reserve currency is not something that changes frequently. I mean, you basically over, I don't know, call it 400 years, you had the Dutch guilder, the British pound sterling and the US dollar. I mean, that's three in, 400 years. But the assumption that we're going to have the dominant reserve currency forever, no matter what we do, I mean, I assume the British thought that too, and the Dutch thought that too. I mean, it's nothing's permanent. And we, in my opinion, have been abusing that status. And the longer we do it, I don't think we're going to get replaced, next year or 2 years. But if this goes on for 30 years, yeah, I mean, I think it's absolutely replaceable.
All right. Well, to close on a more upbeat note, your book ends with six lessons, and one of them is basically the last one is don't bet against the U.S.
I agree.
Despite all the problems. Yeah. So talk to me about that.
So I went into this process pretty pessimistic, and I say this in the last two pages. I went into this process pretty pessimistic, and I started from 1790 and worked my way through. And by the time it was really surreal when I got to like around 1980, and it was probably after 2.5 years, and I was like, I'm finally reading about people I actually can talk to, which is a weird thing. But I kind of got to where we are now, and I'm like, you know what? Relative to some of the stuff I've seen, this isn't that bad. I've definitely seen worse. I mean, the 1940s, if you were living in 1941, looked pretty bad. 1840, same thing, really, really bad. And it's not to say we don't have problems, we do, but every generation that I've, or at least most generations that I've seen over the past 233 years, think like the world's going to fall apart after they're gone. And honestly, a couple generations back there had a better argument than we do. So it's not that we don't have problems, we do, but there is the United States has great natural resources. We have great capital stock. We have great innovation. And once you get comfortable with the fact that we can do great things and bad things at the same time, but that we're slowly moving forward, and there's something about the American philosophy of willingness to fail and innovate, I just think that's still intact. And that's not to say we don't have problems. We do. We have big problems, but we always have. And we will push through them. That's what I believe. And I used a Warren Buffett quote at the end because he reinforces that a lot, not to bet against America. And I agree with him. Now, it's not going to last forever, but I think we got a long, I think we got a ways.
Cool. That's a nice way to close. Actually, before we do, maybe you could tell our listeners how they can find out more about you, how they can order the book, and I will link to that in the show notes. I know your website is enlightenedinvestor.com.
Yeah, the easiest way is probably just to go to direct to Amazon at this point. And most of the sales are going through Amazon right now. And again, I'm an investment advisor at Index Fund Advisors as well.
But not active on social
I have
media.
a bio on my that site. You can go there as well.
But not active on social media.
Oh no, LinkedIn too. I'm
Oh, okay.
very active
But
on
just, yeah.
LinkedIn.
I was going to say that's how you were able to write the book, is by not being active on social media. But yeah.
I guess so.
Very good. All right, Mark, thank you so much for coming on the Contrarian Investor Podcast today. Very interesting. I urge everybody to pick up the book and read it. I read some of it, not all of it, but I will, because this stuff fascinates me. I urge you to as well. And with that, we thank you for listening, and we'll be back again in a couple of weeks. Speak then. Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. We hope you enjoyed this episode. To subscribe to this podcast, simply open your favorite podcast software and search for Contrarian Investor. Follow us on social media by searching for Contrarian Investor on Twitter and Instagram. Send us your thoughts on feedback@contrarianpod.com. We look forward to speaking to you again next time. Traffic jams, tailgating, pile-ups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban two out of every three vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit energycitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.